Welcome to Chasing American History. This is the second episode of our George Washington 101 series, and we're going to get started in just a moment, but first I need to give out a couple of shout-outs. First to the Great Courses series. Now, the Great Courses offers the best college-level courses on CD, DVD, and digital formats. They have over 500 expertly produced courses by professors chosen for their ability to teach. Now, these are lectures that I've been listening to for a couple of decades. They have some of the best teachers in the world on them. And what they have now, which is really incredible, is that you can order them and they go directly onto your phone. You receive the written material as well, so wherever you are, you can check in, you can listen to it, and you can look up on your smartphone and see the names of the books that are used in the bibliography and see the outline as well. So something I can definitely recommend. I also want to tell you about the Museum of the American Revolution. This is a museum that just opened on April the 19th in my hometown of Philadelphia, and if you come to Philadelphia, you definitely want to see it. I was very pleasantly surprised by how good it is, and probably my favorite part, and the favorite part that most people who go there, is the way they present the tent that George Washington lived in at Valley Forge. It's wonderfully done, and it's something you're not going to want to miss. So when you come out to Philadelphia, come to the Museum of the American Revolution. And of course, if you come to Philadelphia, you've got to come to Bowtie Tour. We make history come alive in the city of Philadelphia and in the outlying regions that have some of the most important battles that took place in the Revolutionary War. We have the Battle of Washington Crossing in Trenton. We have the Battle of Brandywine, the Battle of Monmouth. And these are for the real history buffs. This is for the people out there who are listening to this program that want to understand exactly what happened in Monmouth, or want to understand and feel and see the very place where George Washington crossed the Delaware, and hear about the battle in Trenton, the battle in Princeton that preceded it. So please, when you come out to Philadelphia, give us a call at 610-642-2410, or else simply look at our website, bowtietours.com, and order one of our tours if you'd like to. You can also check out our website for this podcast, and that's called chasingamericanhistory.com. Take a look at the vacation packages we offer. We have a George Washington tour, we have a Thomas Jefferson tour, and we have a two-day Gettysburg tour that we're going to be offering. So please, again, if you're interested in any of those, give us a call at 610-642-2410. All right? Now, back to George Washington. Where were we? Well, when we left off, George Washington had just become a surveyor. He found some tools that had once belonged to his father, and it was perhaps not the first choice of the type of life he wanted to have, but it was a choice that made a lot of sense. He was a vigorous young man physically, and this was the type of work that took a lot of physical endurance, a lot of physical work, something that he enjoyed doing. It was also the type of work that allowed him to study land. If you're a Washington, you're interested in land. You want to know what it is. You want to know what it offers. You want to know what it's worth. George Washington is going to spend his whole life looking at the issue of land. And so this was a pretty sensible way to get started. He was also probably encouraged by the Fairfax family. You remember from our last episode, George Washington's brother marries into the Fairfax family, probably the most important family in Virginia at that time, and they're going to encourage him in his surveying, importantly, by giving him jobs. And I believe I've already told you last week what the first words were that he wrote into his journal. They were, "Began my journey in the company of George Fairfax, Esquire." So he's very proud to be taking a journey, in which he's making money surveying, but the most important thing is he's doing this in the company of the Fairfaxes. George Washington is a Virginian through and through, and Virginians care very much about family, and they care very much about family connections. George Washington doesn't have very much family. He's got his brother Lawrence, he doesn't have a father, and he has a mother that he's not exceedingly proud of. So he is very proud to be connected to the Fairfax family. George Fairfax is, of course, one of his best friends as well, and he's also the man married to the woman who George Washington secretly desires. Now, Washington is going to write in his journal a great deal about the level of gentility that he is not receiving as he goes along in these sort of camping trips. He writes, "Went into the bed, as they called it, when to my surprise I found it to be nothing but a little straw, matted together without sheets or anything else, but only one threadbare blanket with double its weight of vermin, such as lice, fleas, etc. But the next night, after vowing that he would from that time forward sleep in the open air, he writes that he had a good dinner prepared for us, wine and rum punch in plenty, and a good feather bed with clean sheets, which was a very agreeable regale." It was during this expedition that George Washington is going to come across his first Indians. This is what he writes. "Their manner of dancing is as follows. They clear a large circle and make a great fire in the middle, then seat themselves around it. The speaker makes a grand speech, telling them in what manner they are to dance. After he has finished, the best dancer jumps up, as if awakened out of a sleep, and runs and jumps about the ring in a most comical manner." Well, there's nothing comical about the situation that George Washington knows that the colonists are in regards to the Indians. I'm sure it's very exciting for a young man, 21 years old, to come across his first group of indigenous Americans, but it's also important. He knows that these people have a very large role to play in whatever George Washington does, because George Washington is interested in the West. He's interested in getting land from the West. And guess what there is in the West? Indigenous Americans, Indians, and they believe that the land belongs to them. So George Washington, as he meets with these Indians, he realizes that these are people that very possibly are going to fight against George Washington, are going to fight off the colonists in their interests of gaining their land. It's all about land with George Washington. So he knows that these Indians are potential enemies, although he would much rather work with the Indians. He would much rather make an agreement with the Indians. Of course, the agreement would have to be everything that George Washington wanted, which would be to basically give Washington any of the land out west that he wanted to be able to have or to purchase. So it's going to be rather one-sided what he wants, of course. Now, I already mentioned Lawrence, who's George Washington's brother. George Washington's brother Lawrence is who he follows, who he admires. He doesn't have a father, but he does have Lawrence. And Lawrence lives the life that George Washington's going to try to emulate. Lawrence is going to participate in the British Navy. Lawrence is going to come back and get land. So George Washington looks at Lawrence and he decides, I'm going to have to do the same kind of thing. I'm going to have to get a military career and then return. Well, Lawrence is going to become very sick with consumption. So sick, in fact, that George Washington is going to travel to Berkeley Springs because it is a place that people believed was a curative. You can go there today. I visited Berkeley Springs a few months ago. They have a place there that says George Washington's Bathtub. Every year they celebrate, they go to this, it's in the outside, it's a big sort of hard surface bathtub that takes spring water into it. There's actually no evidence that George Washington actually bathed in this famous George Washington bathtub, but it's a pretty nice thing. They have a celebration once a year, and hey, so what if maybe it's not the bathtub? George Washington was in that springs, he was in that surrounding area, and it's an interesting area today. It's beautiful out there, and what's really nice is you still have this spring water, so you can go up and you can bring a jug of water and you just open this spigot and it's free to everybody out there. And you're drinking George Washington's water. It's kind of cool. Seemed to me like it tasted better than water. Maybe that was just my excitement. Maybe that was the fact that I was at the place where George Washington had been. But hey, spring water for free? It's $3.50 a pop out here in Philadelphia. So definitely worth visiting. So George Washington's going to go there with his brother Lawrence at any rate. But it's really not going to work. And they're going to take a trip to Barbados. They think maybe that'll work out better. Now, this Barbados trip is interesting because this is the only time that George Washington ever leaves the United States. Now, we've already discussed that as a young man, George Washington believes that he is going to go to London, he is going to visit Europe, he is going to get a European education. That all goes out the window as soon as his father dies. So Barbados is going to be it for George Washington, and he absolutely loves Barbados. He writes all about it. He writes that he was perfectly ravished by the beautiful prospects which on every side presented to our view the fields of cane, corn, fruit trees, and a delightful green. Now, George Washington is also going to see his first play. We're going to talk about what Washington read, what Washington enjoyed, some of the influences on Washington, probably in two episodes. But it's important to know that he loves plays. Now, a lot of people are very opposed to plays at that time. Puritans are opposed to plays. There's times in London, in America, where it's illegal to even present plays. And people think of George Washington as kind of a stick in the mud and kind of a stuck-up person, but George Washington loves parties, George Washington loves wine, George Washington loves dancing and flirting, and George Washington loves plays. He goes and he sees the tragedy of George Barnwell, but Washington seems so insecure about his own opinions that he won't really write any down in his journal for the most part. He writes that the character of Barnwell and several others was said to be well performed. 2 days after he sees the play, Washington is struck down by smallpox. A pretty serious thing back in those days. He is going to survive the disease. And the good thing about that is, in the future, he doesn't have to worry about it anymore, and he doesn't have to get the inoculation. He's going to find that smallpox is more dangerous to his army than the British ever come close to being. He's going to lose a lot of people to smallpox, and it's going to reach the point where nobody's allowed to join the army until they have the inoculation. So once you join the army, the first thing they're going to do is take you off to some place, and they're going to give you the inoculation, and you're going to spend the 3-4 weeks, whatever it takes to get over that, and then you get to join the army and fight for your country at really no pay. At any event, George Washington's going to survive the disease. It's going to have certainly one effect on him, and possibly two effects. The one effect it does have is that it gives him pockmarks over his face. Now you may say, well, I've looked at a lot of paintings and I don't see pockmarks. Yeah, well, we have airbrushing now, we have artistic discretion back then. People didn't want to put pockmarks on George Washington, but he had them. A lot of people write about this in their journals. Now, the other effect it possibly has is to make George Washington infertile. Do we know George Washington was infertile? No, we don't. But we know that he never had any children. We know that Martha, his future wife, had children prior to her marriage with George Washington in her prior marriage. Now, George Washington always assumes that the problem having children is hers and not his, because he's going to write a letter in the future saying that he doesn't believe he's going to have children unless, he says, Martha dies and I marry a much younger woman. So certainly George Washington isn't thinking the problem could have possibly been from him, but it very well might have been, and it was not unusual for that to be one of the effects from getting smallpox. So there you have it. Unfortunately, when they return from Barbados, Lawrence really isn't any better, and Lawrence is going to die. Now, this is devastating to George Washington. George Washington has a mother he doesn't get along with well, and his father died when he was 11, and he had his brother Lawrence to look up to. And now he's lost Lawrence. Now, what effect is this going to have on George Washington? Well, first of all, it's going to increase his dependence on the Fairfax family. They are now his sole connection to higher society. They are now his only mentors. Lawrence left his mansion, Mount Vernon. We discussed this in the last lecture. This was named after a British admiral that he served. He's going to leave this to his widowed wife, and it's going to go to George if he survives both Lawrence's wife and daughter. That's going to happen. And at one point, George Washington's going to inherit Mount Vernon, but at first, Lawrence's wife quickly gets remarried and has no interest in living in Mount Vernon, so she's going to rent Mount Vernon to George Washington, who's going to pay with portions of what he grows on the farm. Now, George is the executor of Lawrence's will, and he learns to his great shock that Lawrence left things in terrible disarray. His brother's books were in a state of utmost confusion, and there were many debts poorly recorded. Now, this was almost always the case with Virginia gentlemen, most of whom owed great sums to England. People talk about, to fast forward, why didn't Thomas Jefferson free his slaves? Why didn't Madison? Why didn't Monroe? Well, we don't know what they would have done if they could have freed their slaves. I'm not saying they would have done that. I'm not saying that at all. But the fact is, they couldn't have freed their slaves if they had wanted to. They didn't own their slaves anymore. They were all in a state of virtual bankruptcy. And lots of Virginians were in a state of virtual bankruptcy. Well, they had beautiful mansions, they had 100 slaves, they had a lot of property, they had no real money, and they were all mortgaged to the hilt to Great Britain. Britain was happy to throw them credit. And this is one of the reasons Virginians are going to quickly join the cause against Great Britain. Kind of like having a war against First Trust Bank or something, right? You mean we're going to fight war against them and that means we don't have to pay our debts? Sounds like a good plan. So that's certainly something that's going to play a role in Virginia's joining the rebel cause. Washington, at any rate, as he looks at these papers, looks at these books, sees the terrible shape that Lawrence is in financially, he makes a promise to himself that he's never going to be in that situation. And George Washington is going to keep that promise. He's not going to end up in terrible debt like his friend and then enemy, Thomas Jefferson and Madison and the others. He's going to be very careful about his finances. And in part, he's not going to just sink everything into tobacco. He doesn't think that's a good idea. He's also going to do other things such as sell fish. He's always looking for other ideas of things to do. Later, Jefferson's going to try the same kind of things. He's going to try to create a nail factory. The fact is, this idea that you can become a rich gentleman by growing tobacco was an illusion. But it was an illusion all the Virginians were only too happy to play. Now that Lawrence has died, George feels an even larger sense of entitlement than he had felt before. He now stands for his entire family. An insult on George Washington is an insult on his brother. It's an insult on his father. And he is going to, soon after Lawrence dies, seek to be the adjutant general of Virginia. Now he's got no qualifications for this. It's as if he believes that he has inherited not only Mount Vernon someday from Lawrence, but he's inherited his qualifications. And Washington's going to ride all around Virginia and introduce himself to important people, and most of them have a positive reaction to George Washington. He's a very sober, serious young man, and if you don't know anything else about George Washington, if you don't learn anything else about George Washington, what you should know is that this is a man who had tremendous charisma. And that's as big a part of his story as anything else, because it's going to be the way he comes across to people that's going to give him the important roles he has. You know, Washington becomes surrounded by some very brilliant people. People like John Adams and Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin. Well, they all look up to Washington. They all look to him as the leader. And that's because of this, you can call it charisma, you can call it the way he interacts. Hard to know without a film why he was so impressive, but we do know that he was impressive. He was impressive to men, and he was impressive to women. Virginia was divided into four military districts, and Washington is given one of those four districts, but he's given the smallest of the four. Now, for most 21-year-old people, that would have been enough, especially considering he's got no qualifications for anything higher. He's never been in the military, but he's going to demand and eventually achieve the post of Northern Neck. Now, that's where he was born, and that was the post that he wanted. And he's going to get that by, again, introducing himself to the important people of Virginia. Now, Washington realizes that in order to achieve the things that he wants, the land, the reputation as one of the leading people of Virginia, he's not yet going to be able to just play the part of a great gentleman. He simply doesn't have the money. Now, Lord Fairfax is staggeringly rich, the patriarch of the Fairfax family, but he spent a lot of his time out west, wearing tattered clothes, surrounded by uncouth neighbors. And George Washington is going to look to him in a lot of ways as the person he's going to follow. Now, many people felt that Lord Fairfax was eccentric, but George understood that Lord Fairfax is where the money is, west. Lord Fairfax is where the land is, and Lord Fairfax is the one out there. His son might be playing the role of the rich young gentleman, but Lord Fairfax hasn't given up acquiring more land, and that's why he spends time out west, dressed in a terrible way with uncouth neighbors, because if you play the game right, you're going to become extremely rich if you can purchase this land out west. And that's what Lord Fairfax wants to do, and that's what George Washington wants to do. Now, like Lord Fairfax, Washington's going to spend a lot of his time in the drawing rooms of Virginia, but he's going to spend most of his time surveying the wilds of the West. Now, Thomas Lewis wrote a very interesting book about George Washington in this period of time, and this is what Lewis wrote. He said, he did not intend to become a Westerner. He ached to become an Eastern aristocrat of the English kind. How he became a Westerner instead of an Easterner, American instead of Englishman, a world leader instead of a down-at-the-heels planter, is worth studying. And Thomas Lewis studies it, and we're going to study it as we go through these early days of George Washington's life. A big part of these early days, a big part of the beginning of our country, a very big part in the French Indian War, is a company known as the Ohio Company. So let's talk about the Ohio Company for a moment. Somebody asked me during a tour last week, when did this combination of money and companies and corporations and politics, when did that all start? Well, you're going to see that it starts before we even have a country. It's probably always been there. And the Ohio Company is an early example of it. The Ohio Company represented the potential for tremendous amounts of money. The Ohio Company consisted of a group of people, mainly from Virginia, maybe all from Virginia, I'm not positive on that, but wealthy landowners who wanted to become much, much more wealthy. A lot of people say, how could a revolution be caused by wealthy people? When does that happen? Well, it happens when people come to a new country because of the promise of unlimited potential. And then they're limited in their potential. The Ohio Company is about unlimited riches. It's about the West. The West is where all the land is. The West is where you have this confluence of rivers. around what we now call Pittsburgh. These Virginians want to get this land. They want to set up trading posts. They want to set up towns. They want to set up trade. They want to use these rivers in order to commit trading all around the world. They want this land. And so you have this group of people in the Ohio Company who are ready to try to get this land, ready to try to purchase this land. However, there are a couple problems. First of all, is they're not the only ones who want this land. There are groups of people in Pennsylvania who want this land. There's groups of people in Maryland who want this land. The other problem is this land is already inhabited. You know by who? The Indians, the Native Americans. They live on the land. That's going to be an issue. But now there's a whole brand new problem. The new problem is that French are showing up on this land. Governor Dinwiddie, who's a major player in the Ohio Company, is receiving word that there are French soldiers, French politicians, French merchants, French people are showing up. They're clearly going to try to get a toehold onto this land. So, Robert Dinwiddie, who, as I said, is a major investor in the Ohio Company and who is also the governor of Virginia, is going to write to King George and request permission to send emissaries to this upper wilderness in order to see if the French are really on British soil. And if they are, he tells the king that he wants to require of them to peaceably depart. King George writes back and gives him the permission. If they are not willing to depart, King George wrote that, "We do strictly command and charge you to drive them out by force." Okay. Now, who is chosen to lead this important expedition with world-shaking implications? George Washington. Now, you may well ask, why on earth was George Washington chosen for such an important mission? Huge implications here. Now, the French and the English are in the kind of relationship where they're either in a hot war or a cold war. Nobody used that phrase, but that's the situation. The British have somewhat recently won the War of Spanish Succession. It took them 10 years. They're vying for land all over the world. So this is not an insignificant issue that the British and the French are both vying for this land around what we now call Pittsburgh. It's, as I say, going to have world-shaking implications. James Flexner, one of Washington's greatest biographers, wrote that it was a mission of world-shaking implications given to an obscure youth. It was deemed by some an extraordinary circumstance that so young and inexperienced a person should have been employed on a negotiation with which subjects of the greatest importance were involved. Extraordinary indeed. Why George Washington? George Washington's had no military experience. George Washington's had no diplomatic experience. He's 21. He's really had no experience of any kind. Well, these are the reasons why George Washington. First, and no doubt most importantly, was the political pressure that was given by the Fairfax family. Second, Governor Dinwiddie wanted somebody to get out there as quickly as possible. Now, Washington was young, and he was able. He was physically strong, and it's snowing out there. He really needs to get somebody young and, as I say, physically strong to be able to go out there. And Washington's had some kind of experience with this kind of thing by surveying. He hasn't been out quite where he's going to go on this mission, but he's been out that direction. He knows something. And people who meet George Washington are forcibly struck by his commanding nature, I suppose is how you put it. So for all of those reasons, he's going to choose him. And George Washington is going to pick to go with him a rough frontiersman by the name of Christopher Gist. Now, Gist had this great reputation for his knowledge of the Indians, and Washington is going to be greatly disappointed when he learns that Gist has no knowledge of Indian dialect and really not a particularly good knowledge of the Indians, although he has dealt with them in the past. He knows what's gone on in the past. So to that level, he's an important help. But What Washington doesn't realize is that this man who he hired as a pilot is really the eyes and the ears of the Ohio Company. And it was the Ohio Company that commanded his true loyalties. The Ohio Company is going to use this expedition being conducted by Washington to try to establish a business relationship with the natives. They don't want any more just this kind of haphazard trade conducted by footloose wanderers. They want an organized enterprise with an established commercial center, or several established commercial centers, and a network of roads. Now, in the company's eyes, this is a first step. They're going to establish trading posts, and then towns, and then centers of settlement, whose first citizens are going to become, as I told you before, staggeringly wealthy. So Gist's job, and Washington has no idea of this, is to try to win from the Western Iroquois tribes expressions of loyalty. Now, what Washington is going to learn is that Gist actually had a better education than he did. He had a wealthier family background, and he had a higher social status. Gist's father, Richard, was one of the commissioners who originally surveyed the town. And what happened was that the family suffered two serious warehouse fires that pretty much destroyed them for the moment economically. Gist is looking to make it big. Gist is looking to become a very wealthy man and a major player. And so he has attached himself to Washington and to this trip in order to do that. Now, he's also along the way to try to get a expression of loyalty from the Iroquois and from the Great Council of Onondaga, which Virginians believed was the main governing force of the Indians. Gist carried with him a secret assignment from Thomas Lee, the president of Virginia's executive council, to try to win from the Western Iroquois tribe these expressions of loyalty that so far, as I say, had been withheld. Now, he's also keeping his eyes out for the competing companies from Pennsylvania and Maryland who had showed interest in the land. Washington was intent on creating a positive relationship with the Indians in the hopes of creating an alliance between them, but just as importantly, keeping them from creating an alliance with the French. If the French get the Indians on board, that's going to be a major, major help in terms of them if there ends up being a conflict between them and the British here on American land. Now, the man Washington is told is the most important in terms of helping him is Tanakorizon, an Indian chief who the colonials call the Half-King. While Gist wants to get Tanakorizon to give him a new deal regarding the land, Washington is more concerned with getting the Indians on the American-British side in case there's this war against France. Now, Washington's perspective of the Indians at that time is probably not very dissimilar from other people of his time. He probably thinks that they are savages, as others do. And we do know that he's certainly trying to dupe them to some extent. He's going to tell the Indians that they and the Americans have the exact same interests, that the French are going to try to take their land, and of course if they defeat the French with the Americans, they'll have nothing to worry about. Of course, Washington knows full well that the Americans are just as likely to try to take the land from the Indians, but he certainly doesn't want that information getting to Tanakorizon. Of course, Tanakorizon's no dope. He knows exactly what's going on, and he knows that either one of these nations is likely to try to take the land. That's why the Indians are being very careful about who they ally with or if they ally with anybody. Now, to Washington and his compatriots, everything the Indians do just proves that they're savages in compared to them. For one thing, they really don't have a leader. Washington and the Virginians, they don't understand this. They say, take me to your leader. Who is your king? Who can we deal with? Well, it's always very complicated. There's these leagues. There's these councils. Tanakorizon, finally, you know, the Indians provide them with a leader. All right, you want a king? Here's this guy, Tanakorizon. But Tanaka Raizen gives orders that are often countermanded. There's different tribes. There's groups within the tribe that seem to be able to veto him. There's even a group of women, and they can't understand this in Virginia, a group of women who are able to veto a war. The tribe leaders can declare the war, but if the women don't go along with it, they can end the war, and they can stop any money from getting to the people in order to fight the war. So this is all very strange to the Americans. The Iroquois League have been seeking to remain as neutral as they can between the French and the British. They need to figure out who's going to win this thing. And at that point, if they have to, they'll ally with them. But frankly, they need to figure out what's in their interest. What Thomas Lewis writes is this: neither Tanaka Raizen nor the Iroquois League cared one shit about who won the contest between the French and the English. They cared about their own future, and in the face of twin invasions by superior numbers with overwhelming firepower, there seemed only two possibilities. One was that the powerful would bleed each other to death before they could get around to dealing with the less powerful. The other was that the Iroquois League could end on the winning side, commanding sufficient gratitude from the winners to strike a reasonable deal. They've been playing these kind of games for a while now. The Iroquois had made an artful deal with both of the contenders previously. At issue was an enormous tract of land north and northwest of Lake Erie called the Beaver Hunting Ground. Now, this area was coveted by the English and the French. The Iroquois basically gave it to both of them. England obtained a deed to the land in return for guaranteeing the Iroquois exclusive, eternal hunting rights. Now, this is one of the things that's going to always create conflicts between the British, the Americans, and the indigenous people. To the Indians, the most important thing about these meetings and agreements is what's said. To the Americans and the British, what's most important is the piece of paper. This isn't something that the Indians really comprehend. They think what's said between them is more important than any kind of piece of paper. And of course, the Americans and the British will say just about anything to get the Indians to agree to sign a piece of paper. Anyway, they're also going to give the land to the French. They make a covenant with the French promising neutrality in any future conflict in return for that country's guarantee of hunting rights. So from the French point of view, the Iroquois recognition of their power to guarantee the rights was tantamount to recognition of ownership. So again, we're looking at these things, the French and the British are looking in kind of legalistic manner, and that's not the way that the Iroquois are really looking at it. Washington has one thing going for him when it comes to dealing with Tanaka Raizen, and that is that the French had dealt with him in the past in an insulting and condescending manner. So the Half-King has no love for the French. So unlike his people, he would rather support Washington and the British, if it makes sense. So let's set the scene. George Washington has the job of confronting the French and giving them a letter from the governor. Tanaka Raizen is going to be coming along with him, and he's going to be watching. He's going to be watching the meeting. He's going to be watching how Washington handles things. He's going to be deciding whether this man and whether these people are somebody he wants to ally with. He was going to be deciding whether the British can stand up to the French. Now, Washington arrives in Venango, and he sees finally a French flag. He can finally talk to the French about what's going on. And he meets with this man, Philip Thomas de Joncaire, who has been a principal agent of the French from the Ohio tribes since 1750. Washington offers him the letter, and he waves it aside, tells him that the commander that he needs to give that to is 65 miles upstream. Well, they all stay up that night drinking brandy. Washington is very careful to remain very sober. It's a trick that Lyndon Johnson used to pull. He would hand out whiskey to everybody, but the secretary understood that Johnson's whiskey was two-thirds water. And he would sit up with all these other lawmakers, and he'd get them all loaded, and eventually he'd finally get them to do what it was he wanted to do. Washington's going to be pulling somewhat the same trick. Maybe he's pouring it out. surreptitiously, but he's sitting up and he's listening to the French as they become more drunk and more boastful. Washington's going to report, "They told me it was their absolute design to take possession of the Ohio, and by God, they would do it." The French were very sure of themselves, and they even allowed Washington to wander around the area and to make careful notes, which gave Washington an understanding of French intentions and their timetable, as well as the location and the size of their fortifications and their supplies and their garrisons. Now, several days later, Washington's going to begin the last leg of his outward journey, northward. The next 4 days were terrible. There was rain, there was snow, there was just terrible traveling through mires and swamps. And meanwhile, as they're walking, they know that the French are behind them and the French are beyond them. So that's not a very comforting feeling. He is finally going to meet up with a French official who can accept this document from the governor, Saint-Pierre. And he tells him at first he's not ready to have the discussion because he doesn't have a proper interpreter. So Washington had no choice but to spend the time wandering around and again studying the fortifications and counting the men. He's then brought back and they read the letter. Dinwiddie had written, "I must desire you to acquaint me by whose authority and instructions you have lately marched from Canada with an armed force and invaded the King of Britain's territories. It becomes my duty to require your peaceable departure." Saint-Pierre reads it, he smiles, he thanks Washington, and then he said he would need a day or so to frame a suitable reply. Meanwhile, Washington can't help but notice that Saint-Pierre is making prodigious efforts to satisfy Tanacharizin. He's giving him gifts, he's giving him liquor, and Tanacharizin may have anger towards the French, but he's willing to go along with all of that. He's willing to take the gifts, and he's willing to take the liquor. Now, Washington sees that the French have really set up an invasion force. He's looking around and he sees that there's 220 canoes and that they're still making canoes every day. This is an invasion force. This is poised to carry French regulars into the American heartland. So it becomes very important to Washington that he needs to get back to Williamsburg to tell Dinwiddie exactly what's going on out here. Saint-Pierre hands over a response to Dinwiddie, and he offered Washington canoes for his return journey. Meanwhile, he's convinced Tanacharizin to stick around. He's been giving him gifts. He's been giving him liquor. Washington does not want to leave the half-king behind with the French. And after a couple days of bickering about it, he confronts Tanacharizin in front of a number of Indians and French and British. He forbids him to touch the brandy, and he orders him into the canoe. Now, there's a long, pregnant pause. If Tanacharizin considers himself to be insulted, this may create irrevocable harm. This may end the possibility of a treaty with England and may send him right into the French arms. However, Tanacharizin seems to have been impressed by Washington's spunk, and he goes along and he gets into the canoe. Wrote Washington, "I can't say that ever in my life I suffered so much anxiety as I did in this affair." Now, what normally would have been an easy journey back becomes long and frustrating. There's ice in some places, the stream is too low for the canoe in other places. It takes them 6 days to get back to Venango, and they're going to leave Tanacharizin there, along with his small band of Indians. Now, Washington and Gist are now on their own. What happened next is of some interest. It's described both in Gist's journal and in Washington's official entry in very different manners. Washington only dedicates a couple sentences to it as if it's not particularly important, but Gist is going to describe it in some detail. The two of them fell in with an Indian that Gist had met before. The Indian offered to guide them, but pretty soon, neither Washington nor Gist really trust this man. Had he been paid by the French to kill them? They don't know. Eventually, the Indian got up ahead a bit, turns around, he points his gun at them, and he fires. Well, he misses. This will be the first time, but certainly not the last time, that Washington will inexplicably survive something that would have seemed like almost certain death. Now, the two of them attack the Indian. Wrote Gist, I would have killed him, but the Major would not suffer me to kill him. We made him make a fire for us by a little run, as if we intended to sleep there. I said to the Major, as you will not have him killed, we must get him away, and then we must travel all night. And this is exactly what they're going to have to do. They have to travel all night. They have to try to keep ahead of this Indian, and they have to keep their eyes open for any people ahead who might be trying to kill them. Now, they reached the Allegheny River, hoping that it would be frozen and they could walk across it. However, wrote Washington, it was not. There was no way for us to get over but on a raft, which we set about with but one poor hatchet and got finished just after sunset, after a whole day's work. Now, despite Washington's keen desire to arrive to Williamsburg, to tell Governor Dinwiddie exactly what's been going on, he is willing to take one day off to stay at Belvoir and visit with his friend, Sally Fairfax. The next day, he gets to Williamsburg to give the information to Dinwiddie. Dinwiddie orders Washington to transcribe the story of his adventures, which he does. Now, Washington doesn't realize he's going to do this, but Dinwiddie is going to publish this small book describing George Washington's journey. And Washington's a little embarrassed. He says, I wrote it in one day, I didn't get to take much time, but it's a good read, and it's a nice first step into world affairs. This is the first time people are going to hear about George Washington. However, many people are going to read this document and think it's a tissue of lies. They're going to cry fake news. They're going to believe that this is all, as Washington wrote, a fiction and scheme to promote the interests of a private company by many gentlemen that had a share in government. Right. Well, they're not crazy. There's a lot of people in the Ohio Company pushing this war. Anyway, George Washington understands that the next move, and Governor Dinwiddie understands that the next move, is to send soldiers out to confront the French in these areas. And George Washington is going to want to be involved in that. Now, before we get to that, how do we look at this, his very first major effort? As a historian, we can really only give him pretty good grades about this. Physically, he got through a rigorous and difficult route. He performed the job he was required to perform, and he came home with much-needed intelligence. He had done all in his power to forge an alliance with the Indians. Now, Governor Dinwiddie, who had been battling on a number of fronts against the emerging patriotic cause of the colonials, wants to create an army to deal with the French. But the House of Burgesses refuses to give him any money for this. He's been battling with the House of Burgesses. We're starting to have the first cries for American, if not independence yet. We're having the first arguments about taxes, about representation and so forth. And the House of Burgesses and Dinwiddie have been fighting for a while now. They're not going to give him any men. So Dinwiddie is reduced to enticing volunteers to enter the service for money. He offers up a proclamation that stated that 200,000 acres of prime land on the east side of the Ohio River had been reserved for later grants to such persons who by their voluntary engagement and good behavior in the said service shall deserve the same. Well, this is land that had been granted to the Ohio Company. So for all of these people who believe there's some kind of alliance between the Ohio Company and the government for the Ohio Company's pecuniary gain, certainly seems to be a lot of evidence toward that end. Dinwiddie is going to make George Washington a major of the Virginia Regiment. Washington feels insulted by this. He goes to a number of influential friends, including a member of the Governor's Council, Richard Corbin, and after declaiming any desire for command of the forces, something he in no way has earned, he wrote, "You gave me some room to hope for a commission above that of Major, and to be ranked among the chief officers of this expedition." Well, it's kind of a lot of gall for George Washington to make this demand, but again, by talking to the important people, he's able to pull it off. He's given the rank of Lieutenant Colonel, which is going to make him basically the second of command. Now, the commander of the expedition is a man named Colonel Joshua Fry. He's a county lieutenant for Albemarle County. He's 54 years old. He's fat. He's a teacher of mathematics at the College of William and Mary, and it's really not apparent why Dinwiddie thought that this overage and unwell teacher with no significant military experience was the right choice to head this grueling expedition into the wilderness that's going to have worldwide repercussions. All the governor would say was that Fry was a man of good sense and an able mathematician. Washington's main job at this point is something that's going to really train him for his main job when he leads the American Revolution, and that's begging people for arms, for money, for uniforms, for food. He doesn't have much more luck in this war than he's going to have in the next war. He's always trying to get wagons. He's always trying to get horses. At one point, there's a warrant for his arrest on a charge of trespassing issued by the Frederick County Court Clerk on April 15th. He must have taken matters into his own hands. The sheriff tried to serve the warrant, but noted on the reverse side that the within-named George Washington would not be taken. He kept me off by force of arms. A few days later, Washington and his men left Winchester for the 80-mile march to Wills Creek, where he's going to go because there's supposed to be a number of wagons and supplies that have been promised to Dinwiddie by George Croghan, this agent from Pennsylvania, and once again, they're not there. But he is going to run into a second lieutenant, Edward Ward, who's going to tell him that the French had forced him to surrender at the Forks. Now, Tanaka had been present at the surrender at the Forks, and he was furious. The Forks is what's later going to be called Fort Duquesne, out in the Pittsburgh area. And Tanaka is there, and he writes a letter to George Washington, and this is what he writes. Have good courage, and come as soon as possible. You will find us ready to encounter with them, as you are yourselves. We have sent these two young men to see if you are ready to come, and if so, they are to return to us to let us know where you are, that we may come and join you. Well, again, Tanaka Risen is always promising 200 men, 2,000 men. He usually ends up sending, like, a 78-year-old man and a 12-year-old boy. But at any event, at least this is very hopeful that Tanaka Risen seems to be indicating that he's going to be on Washington's side. Washington sends back a masterful reply using Indian words and nicknames. He ends it with offering of a string of wampum that you may thereupon remember how much I am your brother and friend. He's going to sign it with his Iroquois name, Conotocarius. He's then going to move, not quickly, but too quickly ahead. So quickly that he's going to end up far ahead of his nominal commander, the fat Fry. What he is going towards is world history. Because in our next episode, you are going to hear about how George Washington fires the first shots in a world war. How he becomes infamous to the British and the French. How he fights during the French-Indian War and the lessons that he's going to learn that are going to become indispensable toward his becoming the general of the American Revolutionary Army. You're not going to want to miss the next episode of Washington 101.